What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast. Now, you might have tuned in if you're a fan of the show and being like, who is this voice? This is a different voice. This isn't Kevin or Peter. Who the heck is this guy? Well, this is actually a very special episode, and I was actually honored to be asked to be the guest host of this episode of the Distance to Empty podcast because we're talking all about Cocodona 250. Now, have I run Cocodona? No, I have not, but I'm running Cocodona for my very first time in May. So, as you might assume, I have a lot of questions. And if you're listening, going into Cocodona for maybe your first time at Cocodona, or maybe your first 200 miler, or maybe you've done it before and you're looking to get some tips from people who have done it not just once, not just twice, but four times, I'm going to be here to be the person to funnel those questions in to Peter and Kevin today. So they're switching the roles and they're going to be the guests on the show today. And I'm your host, Joe Corcione. Just a super quick background on my end. I'm the host of the Everyday Ultra podcast. I'm also a running coach. I've done multiple 100 milers, 50Ks, 50 milers in the past, never 200 milers. So that's, I feel like what makes it a really good scenario here to be asking the questions on here, but super, super involved in the ultra community and very intrigued by the 200 miles. So super honored to be on this podcast here. Now, as y'all know, Kevin, Peter both completed Cocodona like for each of the 4 years, which is just super, super exciting. So they have tons of experiences. They've seen the ins and outs and those things. And my question, like right off the bat to you guys, right? I think Cocodona is very, very well known, and not just the 200s world, but the ultra world in general. And, you know, maybe Peter, we can start with you and then and Kevin can go after. But what's maybe the biggest misconception that people have about Cocodona?
I think the biggest misconception that people have about Cocodona is that it's a super mountainous race where you're just going to be hiking the whole time. But maybe that's true, you know, just for the first 37, but it really is a runner's race. There is a lot of running opportunities. So I wouldn't over calibrate too hard on, you know, just hiking and just, you know, long days at a time on feet. You need, especially if you're going for a, you know, a specific time goal, if you want to be the front end of the race, it's really a runner's race, and you have to have that running training be a key part of your preparation.
Yeah, to take the boring way out, I think I'm just going to agree with Peter. I think most people overtrain for that first section up to Crown King, which is undoubtedly like a super scary section. It's gnarly. It's a ton of gain. It's really rugged and rough, and it's going to be a punch in the gut, you know, out of the gate, but it's 37 miles. And then you have a lot of runnable race, a lot of sections where you can make really good time. So if you're training to be a mountain goat and not much of a runner, you know, kind of neglecting the engine side of things, then when you get beyond Crown King, I think you're going to struggle and find yourself hiking more than you'd like to versus running, which is, you know, something that you can do on a long stretches of Cocodona.
And that's a really good perspective, because like, I think a lot of people, including myself, we hear about the dreaded Crown King section, the first 37 miles, like steep, steep climbing. And even too, like people bring up Eldon and even like lesser so the Sedona climb. But if you do look at that profile, like to your guys' point, like a lot of it is pretty flat, relatively lower grade, like not some super steep stuff. So that's a really, really interesting point to not over index it on the climbs and really focus on the running stuff, which is super, super interesting. I would love to talk about like how you guys specifically train for that kind of stuff. But I guess like another question kind of piggybacking off the first one is, what makes Cocodona different, you know, outside of it maybe just being a little bit more runnable than some of the other, you know, well-known 200s out there? Like what makes it really unique, not just from like a course perspective, but like how you would approach it, how you would train for this thing, like what really makes Cocodona super unique?
Sure, I'll take that one. I think, you know, Cocodona compared to some of the other 200s, especially the ones in this country, are it's much more varied. You know, I think, you know, Bigfoot is a, you know, Pacific Northwest, Green Tunnel, kind of socked in, really beautiful forested race, lots of climbing, you know, rugged but soft trails. Tahoe, kind of the same, you know, alpine mountain trails, pretty, you know, uniform throughout. And same with Moab, you know, yeah, you have the La Salles at Moab. There's a little bit more variety there at Moab, but it's a lot of like desert, slick rock style trails and fire roads. Whereas Cocodona, you kind of have all of that. You know, you start off in the Sonoran Desert, you go into the Bradshaw Mountains, you're going through, you know, towns, some of them like major towns, like Prescott isn't super tiny, you know, Sedona, Cottonwood. And then you're getting up on the Coconino Plateau, and it's like, then you're in the forest. You're in these like, you know, alpine forest trails where you feel like a totally different world than you were, you know, 24, 36 hours ago. So it's the most varied race, both in terms of terrain, but also like weather and like other things you'll encounter out there. So I think you get a little bit more of everything, whereas you can kind of dial in what you're preparing mm-hmm. for, both in training and like mentally for the other races. Whereas Cocodona, you just have to be ready for like anything.
Mm. So good. So good. Peter, you want anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I think it's very true that it's the most varied race. Like the way I like to describe Cocodona is that it's a grittier race to me. Like just going through the towns, you're like going through tunnels, you're going through, you know, overpasses of highways and just popping up out the side of it and then, you know, crossing the road and stuff like that. So it's, you know, when I think of like Moab, it's just so vast and there's stretches where you can see like 20 plus miles ahead of you and what you're in for. But Cocodona, it's just constantly switching things up. And to me, I like that. I like the gritty nature of it and that you are, you know, going through all these towns. There's so much history to the area. So like, I really was appreciating, you know, where I am, like the whole race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so cool that y'all mentioned the variety too. And it's just like, it highlights even the variety of Arizona, which is cool. Like I live in Phoenix and, you know, a lot of people don't even know that there is like the Alpine stuff and you get to see the full breadth of it. But like from a training application perspective too, right? It's not just, you know, training for the mountains, it's training for the desert. It's not just training for the heat, but it's also training for that very, very cold wind that I've heard is at top of Eldon, you know, sometimes at those, if you're getting there in the night section. So it's really just interesting to hear that it's kind of testing, not just like the elements we mentioned, but even to the prior question too about like the flat and the mountainous stuff, which is super, super interesting. And obviously we can, I'd love to talk more about like the race and the specific stuff too. But before we get to like the race stuff, let's just talk about like the training for it, right? Because some people might be hearing this like, wait, like, and you know, you guys made a great point on like having to run maybe a little bit more than you're kind of used to in terms of like the vert and stuff like that. So Peter, I'll bop it back to you to first. How would you like approach, like how have you approached Cocodona training in the past is the first question. And Kevin, I'll have the same question to you too. But the second question on top of it is, how have you pivoted your training after going through it four times to really optimize it, or three times, I should say, to really optimize it to go through it the fourth time?
Yeah, for me, so I've done it twice. I'll clarify, we've done it 3.91 times. So I did have a slight mishap the first time I did it. But I was self-trained the first time I did it. And I was really scared of that, the Crown King section. So I think I did make that mistake the first time around of really just doing too much hiking, too much long days, you know, without really getting as much running in. So the second time around, I had a coach. I was no longer self-trained. And together, we really did a lot. I did a lot more speed work. I did a lot more true running. I got a ton of gain, too, just in the course of training. But I wasn't, you know, doing, like, the first year, like, as an example, I remember one training day was, like, 25 miles with, like, 7,000 or 8,000 feet of vert. And that took me, you know, 7-8 hours. I didn't do anything like that. You know, year two, I had some adventures that were bigger, but my days were more like 25 miles with like 4,000 to 5,000 feet of gain, where I could instead do that more in like 5 hours, you know, instead of that 7. And I think I was just getting a lot more aerobic fitness. It was a lot more, you know, pushing myself a lot more, you know, built, and I had a much better time, the second time at Cocodona. You know, it's 33rd place, which for me, that's toward the front end. And that was a big improvement over my first attempt. So really, really just, yeah, the training. Yeah. A lot more speed.
Mm. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Kevin, same question to you.
I think you had a much better time, Peter, just in general too, just a more fun time.
Definitely.
Yeah. For me, you know, I've been running 200s, since 2018. And I do feel like it compounds, like, you know, it's less about like peak weeks and overall volume, you know, through a training cycle. And it's more like, okay, I've been hitting, you know, 3,000, 3,500 miles a year for, you know, 5 years. I've been, you know, kind of maintaining this high level of volume so that when I go out and run for 3 days on end, it's each year, it's less of a shock to my body because that's just kind of what I've been doing. But in, you know, any individual training cycle, I think it's important to, for Cocodona especially, simulate those sort of sections. Like, you know, here in Boulder, for example, I'll go for, you know, start a run on the Boulder bike path. So the first, you know, 6 miles are going to be flat bike path, paved, fast. And then, you know, you could take the Boulder bike path right up to Green Mountain, Bear Peak, South Boulder Peak, and you can get 8,000 feet of gain and then come back down and have to run a flat 6 miles again. So I think those style of runs where you're tiring yourself out a little bit before you climb, and then vice versa, you're now trying to tell yourself, all right, I need to run 9 minute miles, 10 minute miles, 11, 12 minute miles, like a running pace after having climbed 8,000 feet and I'm at mile 19 of this run. So I think those are really valuable type efforts. And, you know, if I was coaching an athlete who didn't live in a place where that style of run was possible, I'd say, you know, go run the bike path or the streets around your house, and then hop on a treadmill and do like a, you know, 90 minute hike at 12% and then go run again. So stuff like that, just getting creative with like the transition from a more running style effort to a more hiking style effort, and doing both when fatigued is how I'd approach it.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because it goes back to, again, that first question that you were, or the first answer that you mentioned on like the transition from the hike to the run, and practicing that in there as well. Is there any like specific sections like that are like that? And I know the course like well, but maybe for some who aren't as familiar with the course, but like, is there any like maybe sections like what would be some highlight sections to obviously apply that kind of training to, but like also maybe some other sections that you think should be trained for? I know like from when I was talking to people, some people mentioned like the descent into Jerome, super rocky, like that's like a section. Some people talk about like the Kasner climb, like, and so I'm curious, like if you guys were like advising an athlete to say like, hey, like these are some sections, you know, to either, if you are local, get some course recon on, or if like you were to train for specific sections that are kind of like make or break, what would those sections be? And Kevin, I'll start with you since Peter started on the last one.
So the Kasner climb, that's my favorite section. And that's one that's definitely like that. I mean, you start off leaving Sedona, it's super runnable for, I want to say, 5 or 6 miles. And then you have that, like, you know, you cross Oak Creek and it's a steep, steep climb. And then when you get to the top of that climb, you're back on like runnable fire roads for a few miles. So it's very much like that transition from runnable to not runnable, back to runnable, if you have the legs for all of that. Other sections that are like that are Walnut Canyon to the finish, obviously with Eldon in there. And then the section from Crown King to, I guess, all the way down to kind of Prescott has a lot of that as well. So those are the ones that highlight that have sort of that type of transitional terrain in excess. You know, obviously it's everywhere. And then for I forget, what was the second part of the question?
The second part was like, is there any other sneaky sections that maybe aren't like maybe well known, or like they don't get as much noise as like the first 37 miles that people like sleep on, that maybe shock people going into, or maybe I've shocked you guys like being into the race, that like people are like, why, people should be training for this, but they're not talking about it?
Every year I'm convinced that after I forget, you know, time passes, I forget, and I see it on paper, and I'm convinced that I'm going to make like really good time through Fain Ranch leading up to Mingus, because it just looks so pancake flat and not that long. And you could like hurt yourself out there. There's like metal, barbed wire, trash. It's like, it's a minefield, and it's just slow going. Like you're most likely hiking at least 50 to 75% of that section, even though it's pancake flat.
Yeah, I've heard. And that, is that the section too, like where the cows were eating the flags like 1 year too? So it was just like, it was hard to navigate in that section, because it's just kind of like an open field.
Yep. It's an open field with like seemingly no trail or path. Every once in a while I'd be like, oh, the trail. And then like seconds later, you're like, where'd it go?
Oh my gosh. Oh man. Yeah. I've heard about that section too. And that's an interesting one to kind of think about and train for sure. Peter, question for you, like in terms of, you know, thinking about like maybe the times of like week that you're putting into this race, like in terms of just training, like maybe even just this, maybe doesn't get as much Cocodona specific, but just maybe just an insight into your training in terms of like how much time on feet you're getting, vert mileage. And I'm sure it kind of varies each year that you're going into it. And, but like, how have historically you kind of structured those things? And do you think that would be, you know, obviously everyone's different, but just curious to hear like some metrics around your training specifically.
Yeah. For me, I haven't really been able to get my volume up as high as I would have liked. Just for where I am, my history of injuries and whatnot. But for before a 200 like Cocodona, I'm typically doing a lot of weeks in the 60 to 70 mile range for myself, with 10 to 12,000 feet of gain. looking in, you know, anywhere from like that 10 to 15 hour mark, that that's a typical week for me. I'll have a few weeks here and there that maybe are 90 miles. That's like a special week that I'm really picking up the volume because I'm doing a bigger adventure or something like that. But sort of that day in, day out, or week in, week out, you know, for the 12 weeks or so, for me is really that 60 to 70. And another training change I've done too that I think has helped a lot is actually to reduce the weekend volume a little bit and try to get higher volume during the week. So with my coach, I've been doing a lot more runs that are in the 10 mile range on the weekdays, and then capping actually my long. I was overdoing it, I think, on the long runs and running too little. And I think that's made a big difference for me, is getting a lot more boost out of that 60 to 70 miles.
That's awesome. Kevin, would you say your training is similar or a little different? Like how's your training like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little higher volume than Peter's. And I think that's one thing that's cool with these 200s is, like, I think people envision them like the overall training just being like massive and insane and like, you know, unattainable. But, you know, if you compare it to 100 mile training, it's not, it doesn't have to be significantly more, right? Like inherently more. It can be, you know, adjacent and similar to that 100 mile training plan. But for me personally, having been doing these for a bit longer than most, my training is a little higher volume than Peter's. Typically my like everyday volume will be more in the 10 to 15 mile range, and my weeks are more in the 80 to 90 mile range once I'm getting like settled into, you know, where I'm going to sit consistently for a longer block. And I think less of, you know, the importance is not like getting, you know, 100, 120 mile weeks. It's more sitting in a range that like is sustainable, that you can do it for longer than the traditional 3, 4, 6 week block that you might do for a shorter race. I think it's more important to have a range where you can sit in for, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks before kind of taking a break or doing a training race or, you know, having a down period before picking it up again. That's kind of where I think is key for success at these races. So the difference is more consistency and volume over time versus like volume in any given week.
I love that. And I like how you guys have like two different approaches to training. Cause like you, Kevin, you said it great, was like, you know, you can kind of train for these, like depending on like your experience and things like that. And it doesn't have to be this like gargantuan, like 150 mile week, like bonanza for every single athlete in there, which makes like, you know, it a lot more accessible than people think. So that's just super cool. I appreciate that too. And like the interesting thing too, is like when I was looking at, you know, other athletes like a Mike McKnight or like a String Bean or a Mika Fuse, like a lot of these people who do these 200s, like their mileage is relatively similar to like both of yours. And it's like, it's interesting because the thought is like 100 to 250. It's like, I'm already training like 70 miles a week for 100. Like, do I have to do like 140 for 250? Right. And so I love that you guys highlight that, which was great. Kind of getting into the more like race specific stuff, course specific stuff. Obviously, like I have some very specific questions that, you know, I'd love to ask too, but you know, being at this multiple times for both of you, what are some, I always like whenever I race races to share like the mistakes that I've made in hopes that like other people wouldn't make them. So like, what are some like mistakes that maybe you guys made that like would be, you know, helpful for other people to know? That's the first thing. The second thing, what are the things that you guys really nailed that you think people should continue to do based off of any successes? So a little bit of a twofold, like learning from lessons and celebrating the wins. Peter, we'll hit you first with that question.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've made a ton of mistakes out there. I think the biggest mistake that I've made is just not taking care of myself. I think that's something you really need to consider out there for a 200. Is you're out there for many days. Your mental ability to be a rational person and make good choices kind of diminishes as the fatigue goes up. So, and especially if you don't have a crew, if you're trying to go out there all on drop bags and whatnot, you have to take care of yourself. That's super important. So I think just the mindset, you know, I think I've learned to be more objective about myself to better understand my current state and then try to improve it and fix things and go. That's the biggest thing I think I've improved, because if you get into that mindset where things start going wrong and then you have a pity party and then you just tell yourself, I don't care anymore, I'm not going to eat, that's when things go south. So it's just, yeah, you got to take care of yourself out there. I think that's just the biggest overall tip. But in terms of like specific tactics I've done to improve, like one tip I've learned that I think Kevin does as well is I love to have on my watch my lap pace and just take things mile by mile. There's so many sections in Coca Dona where you can move very well. Imagine, you know, you climb Kasner Canyon, you're on the Coconino Plateau. There's a lot of miles that are like flat or 1-2%. So, you know, you really can move like 14 minute miles over there, you know, but if you hike, it's going to end up being like 18 to 20 minute miles. So I force myself to have that lap time on, and I force myself to run because I've told myself, all right, this has to be a 15 minute mile or less. So I'm going to push a bit just to get that to happen and just repeat. And that's where you find a lot of time out on the course, is just forcing yourself to move quicker than you would otherwise if you just defaulted back to hiking.
That's a pro tip right there. I'm definitely using that one. So that is freaking great. I'm right after this call, I'm going right in the Coros menu and I'm putting lap time on my trail run setting. So that is awesome. Kevin, same question to you. Mistakes like that, you know, you would advise someone to avoid, and then also things that you've done really well that you're carrying into going forward and would suggest others to do.
Yeah. So first I want to add more to that lap pace, because that is one of my favorite things to do as well. And I think it's really important, like, you know, mentally thinking about it, is like you treat every individual mile, you know, in and of itself. So if you have a bad mile, if you have a mile that's taking you 48 minutes, like as soon as it ticks over, it's done. Like you're like, it's a fresh start every mile, and that pace calculator resets every mile. So it's important not to like dwell on the previous one, because you could really find yourself spiraling like, oh man, they've all been so slow. So, you know, you're just trying to win the one you're in. And if you don't, like, move on when it ticks. But to Peter's point, like, it might sound counterintuitive, like it's a 250 mile race. Am I really going to track every mile? But like, by staying sort of in the moment and in the mile, things tick by real quick. Like you'll have done five of them and it feels like nothing, like no time has passed. So I really do like utilizing that. And I do sometimes either ignore it or turn it off on a section, like going up to Crown King, because it's almost irrelevant, right? Like they're slow. You're not moving well on that section. But on the sections where you can move well, and the only thing that is slowing you down or stopping you is generally your brain, like make those sections count and use that tool there. Anyway, going back to the question of kind of mistakes and kind of wins at Coca Dona. So these 200 aid stations are like, you know, they're oases, and they're so far apart sometimes that you kind of fantasize and think about what you're going to do there. And it's so easy to spend so much time. So like, I'm trying to be competitive at these races. And I think last year, according to Strava, I had 12 hours of stoppage time, which is insane. It's like, that's 12 hours of moving 0 miles an hour. So I think my mistake is going in with the best intentions and not being as efficient as I think I could be. Now you definitely have to take some serious time at these aid stations. Like it's maybe the biggest difference between a 100-miler is that, you know, even the people winning these races are taking significant downtime at some point, whether for sleep or for, you know, to Peter's point, self, just taking care of yourself. But I think 12 hours is excessive. And I could tell you that most people take far more than that. So that's one of my goals this year, is to keep cutting down on that. I think that there's room for improvement there. And I think being aware of it and staying kind of keeping it part of your active plan throughout the race is key, because it's very easy to fall into the comforts of those aid stations.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, too, like to highlight too, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people know this listening to the podcast. I mean, you were fourth male like last year at Coca Dona too, with like 12 hours. So like, that's like, I mean, your moving time is like pretty fast, like with that, which is really, really cool to see too. And I've heard like, it's a big thing to manage that aid station time and stuff like that. So I'm sure it depends on like the aid station and sleep, which is definitely something I want to talk about. But would you guys suggest maybe like, you know, if there was a range between like where you'd want like your aid station time to be? And of course, I'm sure it depends on the section, what you need to do, if you need to sleep and all that stuff. But would you kind of have like an ideal kind of number that you'd put it on, especially with, you know, Coca Dona, 250 miles, it's 50 more miles than some of the other standard 200s on paper. And so like, curious to hear if there was like an ideal aid station time maybe people should target for.
Yeah, I think it depends on your goals. Like if you're trying to be competitive, I think you need to be, you know, under 10 minutes at aid for the first 100 miles for every aid station.
Oh, wow.
You know, so for the first 100 miles, you're kind of racing it like it's a 100-miler. Maybe you're taking a little extra time here and there. But generally, And this is mostly speaking for from personal experience. Like I'm pretty cruisy through those first six or seven, eight stations, say through like, you know, Fane Ranch or wherever it is. And then you're going to have to start spending some more time. Usually I think Mingus Mountain is where I usually spend like some significant time. And then you're starting to look at like 15 to 30 minutes per aid station. And maybe it's not everyone, but it is starting to get up there. And that's when sleep starts coming into play. So, you know, if sleep's going to be a factor at an aid station, then you're probably looking at even longer than that. As far as ideal time for me, I think like a reasonable goal, if you take, you know, say an average of 30 minutes per aid station for the whole race, I think that's somewhere around 7 or 8 hours. I think that would be something I could aim for. But again, like it's a really delicate balance, because what you don't want to do is not take care of yourself and then have 4 to 6 hours to the next aid station. Like you need to address what you need to address, but you know, you might not need, you know, the foot rub and the extra recliner chair. Who knows?
Gold advice. And Peter, like, what are you targeting in terms of like aid station? Like when you're kind of in there, like how do you approach those things in the similar format that Kevin mentioned, where you're like, you're in and like, you're mindful of the goals, but like, you're also like, you know, taking care of yourself as well. And, but not wasting too much time.
Yeah. For me, yeah, I'm not trying to win it, but I'm also just trying to do well. I'm trying to do as well as I can. So I actually kind of take a similar approach where I'm trying to be as efficient as possible. I give myself the grace that on day three or four, like 30 minutes is good, but I'm definitely trying to be in on day one, you know, 10 minutes or less. You know, I think what a good tip is just, you know, in the couple miles leading up to the aid station, start making your mental plan about what you're going to do. That's a great use of time, you know, to zone in, have a plan. What am I going to do? Get it done and then get out of there. So yeah, I think I had like, I can't remember. It was like either between 15 and 18 hours of downtime I had. So a little slower than Kevin, but for me, that was good. But I see how I could get improve that even further.
Mm-hmm. And what I love about like that answer too, is that it highlights like, no matter what your goal is at Cocodona, whether it is to like be competitive or whether it is just to like do the best you can, like aid station efficiency still matters, like no matter what. Like, and so I think that's just, it's like such a cool thing. Like any other like tips, like maybe like into the nitty gritty of like how to be like super tactical. Peter, you had a great tip on like, you know, just kind of making that plan ahead in the beginning, but like, is there some things you can do with your crew or drop bags or like, obviously not every aid station has crew, but like, obviously it's a good tool to have. So curious, like any other like crew efficiency tips. And Peter, we'll start with you, because you had that awesome tip too about the menu thing. So we'll keep the momentum rolling. Like, what are some other stuff you can do to really be efficient in the aid stations at Cocodona?
Yeah. So I create a plan ahead of time where I have a spreadsheet that I give to my crew with all the information about the race. And I have different aid station strategies depending on whether it's night, whether it's day, whether it's going to be night. And maybe specific aid stations that are special, like Crown King or something like that. But it's just super clear. What do I want for this section hydration wise? Like if it's night, less, more water, less electrolytes. If it's heat of the day and, you know, earlier in the race, like Sedona or the start, heavy, you know, electrolytes. And my crew knows exactly what that is. They're going to have it there. And that's key. You know, if I want something special for the aid station, you get cell coverage a lot. So I'm texting people ahead of time. So pro tip, Starbucks, Frappuccinos, that's my secret sauce. So I think at Cocodona, I had like at least four of those, and, it all just things come down to planning and then executing on it. You know, when it's time, you know, make sure your crew has food for you when you arrive, right? They can have the aid station cook that hamburger or quesadilla or whatever and have it all ready to go before you get there. It's just, you can gain a lot of efficiency. Just be intentional about what you're doing. If you need to sleep, that's fine. Take the hour, but just don't sit at the campfire for an hour doing nothing.
So good, man. So good. Kevin, same question to you.
Unless they're making s'mores, then maybe the campfire is the way to go. You know, I think Peter nailed it there. I mean, I make a lot of phone calls at Cocodona. You have service for, you know, maybe over 75% of the course. I let my crew know what I'm feeling, you know, like, you know, what kind of food they can get me. If they can't get me what I need at that aid station, chances are they can do it by the next one. Cause there's, you know, there's fast food restaurants, there's grocery stores, lots of gas stations. The course is super crew friendly. So you can generally, you know, acquire what you need at least an aid station away. So I'm definitely letting my crew know what I'm craving, what I'm feeling like, and what my like vibe is coming in so that they can plan to like, all right, he needs some tough love, or he needs to be coddled, or he needs to sleep, or he needs to get his ass out and back on the trail to the next section. He's chasing someone. So they kind of know what's coming, you know, when I'm still an hour out. But yeah, I think, you know, just don't be afraid to ask too. Like if you don't have crew, if you're going solo, like if there's something you're craving, like, you know, ask, they might have it, or they might be able to get it for you, or someone else's crew might have it. Like, man, if someone has something that you want, 9.5 times out of 10, they're going to give it to you. Like it is a helpful group. You know, the volunteers, the crew, the aid stations, like, don't be afraid to ask. Worst case, they'd be like, no, we don't have that.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, this is gold. Information from both of your ends for sure. Like, I think it's that, and that's like such a good point about Cocodona specific. Like, I love how Kevin, you mentioned like the cell service, right? Because if you do a race like Bigfoot, like you are out, like, you know, no cell service for stretches and stretches where you don't have that, you know, luxury to be able to do so. So that's a really cool course specific thing. And Peter, dude, I love that tip on like making like the weather and time of day dependent rules for each aid station. It's not just like at this aid station, give me this. It's if at this aid station I arrive at nighttime, give me this and this and this. So that way, you know, you're playing to the variables of the different temperature. Similar question in that vein, and it kind of relates to a little bit to the sleep thing too. Is there ways that you guys suggest to ideally structure sleep in ways where like you're avoiding hot sections being too hot or cold sections being too cold or like sketchy sections at night? Like, do you guys think about those things with Cocodona, or is it more like you plan it by specific aid station no matter what? Like, curious to hear like how you would like approach sleep in the specific Cocodona setting. I mean, Kevin, we'll start with you on that question. I'm curious to hear that.
Yeah, I think sleep is like, it's the biggest puzzle for most people, myself included. Yeah. I think I've slept differently at each of my 9 200s. Like, it's not something that it's like a formula for me at this point, which is surprising to myself. At Cocodona, you know, I've never struggled to sleep in the heat. Like, if it's too warm, you can generally find a shady spot. I've never been too troubled by sleeping in the heat of the day. I have definitely struggled to sleep in the cold, and it doesn't take much. Like, if it's dark and like 50 degrees, I'll start shivering. If you're planning on, you know, utilizing trail naps, which sometimes you don't really have a choice, it would behoove you to carry enough warm clothing. You know, somewhere around the halfway point of the race, your pack's going to be so heavy anyway that you might as well have the gear that you might need, and your pace is going to be slow enough where it's not going to be a huge limiting factor. Like, it's not going to be weighing you down. So take the puffy, you know, take the pants, carry the mandatory gear, and be prepared to sleep at night if you need to. And I definitely, my sleep plan is as fluid as it can be. I never say I'm going to sleep at that aid station. I never say I'm going to sleep in this particular spot. I'm always looking for like indicators that I might need sleep. And we've definitely mentioned this before on the podcast, but for me, I use that lap pace feature for sleep as well. So I know like if for the last like hour or two, I've been ticking off, you know, 18 minute miles, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting grumpy and now I'm ticking off 22 minute miles for the last two. But the terrain hasn't changed, right? So that's a huge telltale sign, is like, okay, you're slowing down. So you either need to eat or sleep. And if I've been eating, then it's sleep. You know, I'll try whichever one I need to first. Another sign is, have I not been eating? Have I stopped eating? Because I'm pretty good at eating during these things. And if I've stopped, I probably need to sleep. The last thing I look for is if you start tripping, there's a lot to trip on a Cocodona. And if you're doing it multiple times per mile, you might need to lay down. So those are kind of the three like scenarios I run through where I'm like, all right, Kev, like you're off, like something needs to change here. And then if I'm nearing an aid station, I then formulate a plan of, you know, where and when I'm going to sleep there. Or sometimes I'll just plop down right where I am and sleep there.
So good. I should be paying you guys for this information. This is so freaking useful. Peter, same question to you on how do you approach sleep specifically in the lens of Cocodona? Like, how have you approached it the years you've done it? Like, curious to hear if it's similar, different than Kevin's strategy. Like, would love to hear your sleep approach.
Yeah, for me, a couple sleep tips. One is, if you lay down to sleep for an hour and you can't actually fall asleep, don't let that psychologically mess up your race. Everything is fine. It's there's some benefit from just resting and laying there. Just get up and go. It's fine. You'll end up sleeping when it happens, but don't let that be a psychological spiral. Cause that's happened to me the first year.
Huge.
That's one. Yeah. A second thing is, at least for me, I sleep better in a car. Just, I don't know. I'm not good with sounds of other people trying to sleep around me, snoring and all that. So I tend to avoid, you know, the sleep stations. So if you have a crew and you can actually sleep in a car, that's huge. And also for that problem of sleeping in the cold, that is hard to sleep in the cold. So I think that's one of the key elements that a crew really helps with is that car access for sleeping. If you don't have that, it's worth having a sleeping bag at certain aid stations. If you're doing this solo, like Munn's Park, if you're there in the night, that place is absolutely freezing and you can't sleep without a sleeping bag for sure. Yeah. And I guess my last tip is, like sometimes you get better sleep than other times. So like give your crew the freedom to make a call that it's okay if you sleep longer. Like they're watching you. They can see if you're restless or not. So if they tell them, like, if I'm actually sleeping, it's fine if I sleep for, you know, 80 minutes here instead of 45. That's actually going to be a lot more beneficial. Is if you are actually sleeping, getting that extra is going to save you from, like, if you're really tired, you're going to get into this cycle of just taking trail nap after trail nap after trail nap, and it's not helping as much. So you'll make up all that time, that 30 minutes, you know, you'll easily make up that time by moving so much better the next section.
That's such a good piece of advice. Cause like you're probably telling the crew like, hey, get me in, get me out of, like, you know, sleeping for 60 minutes and 60 minutes goes off. You're like, I was just falling asleep. And then they're waking you up. So like having that communication, I could see could be helpful. You guys mentioned some cold sections, Munn's Park. Yeah. I crewed last year. I was at Munn's. I was freezing my butt off. I wasn't even running. So I was like, geez, this section's cold. And then, you know, there's some sections that are blazing hot, right? Like Sedona can get that way. That Lime Kiln, trail section, everybody notoriously knows about the Crown King section, which I'll definitely talk about too. Is there any sections that you guys look at that you're like, you will avoid to try and do this at specific times of the day intentionally? Or is it more so just like you kind of go into it and just kind of roll with the punches and how it comes in? Like how is that kind of approach? Like, Kevin, I'll start with you.
Sure. I just have two more quick sleep tips that I thought of while Peter was going there that I think are really valuable. So one, have your crew have noise canceling headphones if you can. Even if you're in a quiet car, it's really like to put on some like fan noises or something like in noise canceling headphones, game changer for me. And then something that's really important that I think a lot of people don't do, and this is something you can make sure your crew is aware of, is like if you're going to sleep, take in 1,000 calories and a liter of fluid with electrolytes before you sleep. Like to have a big meal, have a ton of fluids, and then go to sleep. You are going to wake up feeling so much better than if you don't. You're going to wake up feeling like death if you go in there, you know, without fueling first. So use the opportunity of sleep as like a fueling reset where you almost like simulate a meal and then, you know, dinner and then sleep. I think that's really, really important.
So good. So good. I mean, yeah, I literally wrote down in my to-dos, as you said that, buy noise canceling headphones for Cocodona. So I'm putting that to use for sure.
And then to your question, which was, you know, do we kind of aim to hit, you know, certain sections at certain times? In a perfect world, like, yeah, that'd be great because there are sections that are easier at night, easier during the day. But for me personally, no, I don't feel like I have the wherewithal or ability while I'm out there to actually like execute on that and make it happen. You know, I've been lucky enough to, you know, hit Sedona at night every time I've done it, which is, you know, a shame because it's arguably the most beautiful section of the course. But I've avoided those 80, 90 degree temperatures going through Sedona because I've hit it at night. And yeah, that's really nice. But I don't think it's like, I think it becomes too complicated of a puzzle if you try to like time sleep to hit certain sections at certain times. And I think there's more to lose than to gain there, if I was to guess.
Such a good point. Peter, same question to you.
Yeah, I don't sleep very well during the day. So I just, whatever happens, happens, let the course come to me. So if it's hot in Sedona, I've been through it twice in the heat. It's just different challenge. Just deal with it.
Yeah, I like that approach. Yeah, because I've heard like a few different like transit camps, like where they're saying, like, oh, like sleep this section because you don't want to do this at night and things like that. So I was curious to hear like your approach. So yeah, it sounds like just like be adaptable to the situations and, you know, wherever the cards fall, that's where it goes. And yeah, so that's good advice to know. Now, we mentioned the section and I purposely hadn't brought it up like right off the bat, but like everyone talks about the Crown King section. They're like, watch out for Crown King, watch out for Crown King. Obviously year two, you know, we didn't have that Crown King section due to like the burn and everything like that, but it is back in this year in full force for sure. To alleviate the fears of many people, also the guy asking the questions here too, aka me, what is your tips? Like, how do you survive this section? How do you, I guess survive is like a harsher word, but like, what are your pro tips for this section? I know that Aravaipa is putting on a training run, you know, for Cocodona for the first 37 miles here, but maybe for those who aren't listening, we're like, I can't make it. Like, what do I do? What would be your best approach for that section? And Peter, we'll start with you on that question.
Definitely you need enough water to get through it and electrolytes. That's the key. Like last year was a great year too, because there was still water crossings, there was filterable water, but I carried 6 liters and I drank at least 7. So it's a lot. Yeah. It's 90 degrees getting up into the altitude and you're on your own for like 10 hours. You got to have a lot of fluid. So that's the key. You know, I think just stay within your own abilities. Don't try to make anything happen. My mental approach was the race starts at Crown King. Like number one goal is get yourself in okay shape to Crown King. And then the race starts, but it's do no harm. Just be a mule, carry a lot of fluid. Don't make anything happen. Don't push, and just get there. And then the race starts.
So good. So good. Kevin, same question to you. Crown King survival tips.
Yeah, I think, you know, to Peter's point, like stay within your ability. Don't worry about it. It is such a small part of the race. I think I was like 20th into Crown King. So, you know, it means nothing. You're going to catch most of the people if that's a concern of yours. Like the race is not won to Crown King for sure. And I think to alleviate some of the fears, like, don't get me wrong, it's really hard. It's bar none the hardest part of the course. Like any 30-mile stretch of the course is not going to compare to the first 30. It's the hardest. But I think when people hear, you know, oh, the first 50K has 11,000 feet of gain, like they're thinking in terms of like a 50K race, whereas it would have equal amount of descent, right? So it's a loop or it's a out and back, or, you know, it's kind of identical and it's a point to point. So I think there's only about 4,000 feet of descent. So it's not 11,000 feet in 15 miles, which is what it would be. That's how most people are thinking of it, right? It's not quite as concentrated. It's not quite as steep as people think it is. It's a little more spread out. There's less descent to get in the way of that gain. And it's, you know, and now that I'm underselling it, people are going to be like this guy. But I remember thinking it was easier because people talked about how hard and how scary it was. And I was like, you know, this is hard. Definitely hard, but it is not as scary as people think. So it really is about, you know, like you said, surviving it. It's about getting through it, taking really good care of yourself, almost like not worrying at all about how long it takes you to get to Crown King. And then it's like, all right, now I have a 215 mile race to work with here. And I'm in good shape.
Yeah, so good. Both of you guys, I love the theme of just like the race basically starts at Crown King. And it's just like really the first 37 miles, take care of yourself. Like, don't be a hero. Like, which is always like, I mean, listen, like a very hard part because like, you know, we're fresh in the beginning. We're excited. Like, you know, everyone's just like rowdy and getting ready to rip out there. So that is a good piece of advice for sure. With the risk of like maybe getting more into like 200 specific, I'm talking like maybe Cocodona specific. So I know Peter, you mentioned like carrying 6 liters of water. And so is there any, like, I guess including to that with like water stuff, but is there any like gear specific stuff for Cocodona? And like this question more aimed for like Cocodona specific gear for like this race, like not 200s in general. I mean, of course you can throw in some stuff that there is some essentials, but like anything at Cocodona where maybe if someone's done 200s before where it's like, you know, this piece of gear probably useful, like with just the desert terrain or like the high altitude or just anything that, you know, you think would be Cocodona specific gear wise that you use in the past that maybe are unorthodox to other races. And Peter, I'll start with you first.
I can't think of anything other than, yeah, just the high capacity ability to carry liquid for the first part. You know, some people switch shoes to road shoes for certain sections. Mm. I just use the same shoes the whole time. I wear Olympus 5s. But if you could do that, like from Jerome to Dead Horse, that might be a road shoe section. Through Prescott, that might be a road shoe section. But in terms of other gear, I just go with my usual. And like Kevin said, you got to be prepared for the extremes. You know, Munn's Park in 2022 is less than 20 degrees and, you know, gets over 90 degrees in Sedona or the start. So, yeah, I tend to carry, you know, a lot of gear the whole time just so I can troubleshoot anything that comes up. I don't want to let my mental abilities lapse and just not have something key. I'd rather just sacrifice, you know, a little weight just to make sure I'm safe the whole time and I have what I need.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Kevin, what about you gear wise?
I think Cocodone is the only race where I carry a credit card. There are a few opportunities to pop into a gas station, restaurant, and get things that you might not normally be able to get, especially like if you're going solo, if you don't have crew, you know, and there's something you want that is not typically offered at aid stations. Like there's a good, at least three opportunities going through Prescott, Cottonwood to do that. Like there's a 24-hour Maverick leaving Prescott. They have burritos, you know, all the drinks, candy in the world. So I carry a credit card because it's almost like, even if I don't need it, it's kind of like a fun, like weird, like return to society, like entering a store during a 200 and like making a transaction and like getting something you want. It helps like mentally too. It's like, I'm a normal person. I'm doing normal person things. So I always enjoy doing that if I can during a race.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that is awesome. I wouldn't have thought about that. But yeah, it's probably just like, wow, like I'm back in society, like, you know, the Robin Williams Jumanji just coming into like the middle of the, you know, city and something like that. And just like having that dopamine hit from that transaction must be really, really helpful. So that's a good piece of advice. And yeah, Peter, to echo like your thing too, like being adaptable to the environments, having the gear, even if it like has like a little bit more, just having that peace of mind in terms of just like the weight on there is great. How do you guys, this is the part that I'm a little bit struggling on that, you know, I'm sure maybe other people are right. We hear again, to go back on the water, like 6 liters of water, what's the pack setup? Like, how do you efficiently do that? Like, you know, to do it in a way where it's comfortable, but you're able to get it all in, like, cause obviously the minimum requirements 4 liters for the first part of the course, most people sounds like should be taking a lot more. And for the people trying to fit it into a pack, like how do you guys set all that stuff up? Peter, we'll start with you.
Yeah. I use the Salomon 12-liter pack.
Ooh, 12 liter.
Okay. And I stuff a 3-liter bladder in there to start. So I got 3 liters in a bladder. I made that just super high concentrated electrolyte fluid. And then I had the flasks in front, so that's 4 liters, and then I had an additional 1 liter that had even more water in it, and then I had just like a couple Gatorlights in the pack, so all of that added up to 6.
Nice. The Gatorlights is a power move. That's awesome. Kevin, how about you?
Yeah, well, Peter and I are both all about like stuffing in like bottles of like Coke or Gatorlight or like, you know, just something different, right? It's gonna hit really well when it's time. Same pack as Peter, Salomon Advanced 12, little bit different. I, do a 2-liter bladder for that first leg, bottles up front that gets me to 3, and then 1-liter soft flasks in the side of my Salomon pack, like the backside, like sort of on your, you know, lower back. So that gets me to 5 liters. I think, you know, hopefully Steve, the race director's not listening, but I think what's key in that first 37 miles is, you know, you really don't need too much like before you get to Crown King. Like you can kind of load up on like your main headlamp, you know, your layers, your changes of clothes, all your like traditional like, oh crap, 200 gear that you should be carrying the whole time. So I went pretty light, you know, being a relative, light other than just water and fuel. So I had pretty much just water and calories in my pack and like the bare minimum of everything else.
That's a good piece of advice for sure, because like 6 liters or, you know, 5 liters, however you're carrying, is heavy, and to like be as efficient as possible with that is huge. Anyways, we're getting to the tail end of the episode. I could literally keep you guys for like 5 hours on end. So there's tons of questions I have, but this episode has just been amazing. Like I learned a lot just even racing the race. There's so much good actionable insights. I guess the last thing to ask you two, like before we jump, and Peter, I'll go to you first, because I know you got to jump in 4 minutes. Anything we didn't cover that you think is a must need to know for Coca Dona, whether it's training, racing, anything that's a must need to know that maybe we didn't cover today that you think everybody should be well aware of if they're toeing the line of Coca Dona?
Just it's an amazing adventure. Like Kevin said, that Fane Ranch, there's sections that just suck. You just got to get through them. The Fane Ranch sections like that, coming off Mingus is like that. But yeah, there's some amazing climbs once you get past Crown King. Like, there's no climb that's they're all fun. I almost want the climbs more than anything, right? Like, at a certain point, running downhill is terrible. The flats, like I was saying, you really got to coach yourself to move efficiently over that. So I love the climbs. So just, yeah.
That's the mindset. Love the climbs. That's the mindset we need into the race. I love it. I love it. Kevin, how about you, my friend?
Yeah. Just embrace the adventure. It's so cool. Like, the whole valley comes out, like, whether or not they know they're part of the race, they are. Like, I had people in Cottonwood asking, like, what are you doing? And like, I actually would like stop and like, you know, stood in front of some guy's porch for like 10 minutes, just telling him all about the race. And he used to live down in Phoenix. He went to school in Flagstaff. Now he's in Cottonwood. So he knew like the whole course. He was like super interested. He was like, I'm going to go inside and Google it and track you guys. So like, you're part of like, you know, something that Arizona is experiencing in that period of time. And I think it's really cool to embrace that and know that like, you're doing this for, you know, there are very beautiful parts of the course. There are pretty shitty parts of the course, like, you know, where there's just like trash and glass, but that's like all, you know, like don't focus on that. And like, you know, be cursing the race director because it's part of it. You're traversing through like, you know, these historic towns, these historic landscapes. And I think it's such an incredible journey. There's a reason I keep going back. And anyone who's toeing the line for the first time or going back, you know, they know what they're in for. It is really unlike anything else I've ever experienced. And I guess the last thing I'd say is, you know, don't underestimate how hard it's going to be, but welcome that and just kind of be prepared for it when it does get that hard. And you know, that's what you're signing up for when you sign up for a 250-mile race. Don't kid yourself, but embrace it.
Dude, great pieces of advice. And let me tell you, just from this whole episode, I think you have saved me tons of time, tons of stress and tons of pain that I would have experienced otherwise without talking with you guys. And I'm sure you have for a lot of people listening in as well. So this was so beneficial. This is the reason why you guys are rocking this podcast and why you give so much value. So thank you again for the episode, boys. Appreciate it.
Heck yeah. Thanks for being here with us, Joe.
Of course.
Well, that was really fun. I hope listeners had as much fun listening to that as we did recording it. It was really cool to have the tables turned on us and take the role of host for a while. Big thanks to Joe. Peter and I are big fans of Joe, everything he's doing over at the Everyday Ultra podcast. Super good stuff. If you guys haven't checked out the Everyday Ultra podcast, there's tons of great information over there on all things ultra. So go check it out. Give Joe a follow. Give the Everyday Ultra podcast a follow. But yeah, big thanks for him coming on and guest hosting Distance to Empty.
Yep. I guess my reflection on this is I think I give great advice and I could work on following my own advice. So growth opportunity for 2024.
Yeah, there you go. I was like, man, this is really good stuff that Peter's spitting here. Like, great, great tips, great advice. And then, you know, you see you out there racing, just not doing any of that.
I'm getting better. Getting better.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was awesome. So hopefully you guys had some great takeaways for anyone running Coca Dona or who wants to run Coca Dona. We hope there were some tangible takeaways from that for you.
So should we get into some categories?
Yeah, why don't you kick it off as always with our performance of the week? What do we got?
So this week, we have a whole crew getting performance of the week. So there was the Ventura Marathon where a number of our friends went and pretty much, yeah, I think actually everyone crushed it, especially the Kim family. So MK, our friend, ran sub 3 as well as two of his kids. So that's really impressive, especially one of them. She's like 12 or something, and I think she's going to be in the Olympics one day. So kudos to them and Nam, Joe, Sid, Rob, and Bob. All of you did amazing out there. So kudos to everyone.
Yeah, it was fun tracking the Ventura Marathon. It's crazy. You can track a race that's over in like 3 hours. I'm used to tracking races over the course of like a weekend into a week. But yeah, it was really cool seeing those guys crush those goals. And yeah, I think MK's kids won, son won his age group, and daughter was second overall for the whole marathon, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think she's going to start to become famous from this one.
Yeah, really cool. All right, let's jump into our snack review. Peter was really like eager to eat the snack today. I don't think he's had lunch, so like we had to like make sure that we timed it because he was ravenous. So Peter, why don't you tell us about our snack review today? What do we got?
All right, we have Doritos Bits honey barbecued flavor. So these are from Belgium. They're basically little bits of Doritos in a almost gel-like tube here. So I guess it's a bag. So yeah, I think you could almost use this like a gel. The barbecue flavor is good. I didn't really taste any honey. Yeah, I could totally crush this in a race. The funny thing is it gives a Nutri-Score on it. It gets a D. So apparently not much nutrition, but I think it's good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And it does come in like a tubular bag that you could almost like take as like a shot. So I think it would go down easy if you were carrying a couple of these at an ultra, like a shot of chips or like bits of chips. Yeah, it was good. We got to order up a new batch of exotic snacks. So if anyone has any recommendations, these snacks were from Galactic Snacks, and we're running low on our snack review inventory. So let us know if you have any recommendations on that.
Sounds good. All right. Is it that time?
It's time to play Let's Get Deep. Let's Get Deep is a card game for couples. Peter and I play it on the podcast. There are three categories: icebreaker, deep, and deeper. And we take turns asking each other these questions. So I'll kick it off with your icebreaker, Peter. What is your favorite band or musical artist?
My favorite band is Tool. I've seen them a number of times. I've been a fan of them since they started with like Undertow in the mid-90s. So listen to a lot of Tool and all the derivative bands, A Perfect Circle, Pussifer. Yeah, huge Tool fan.
Haven't you listened to like the same Tool album like on repeat for like 200 miles?
Well, that was actually Nine Inch Nails. But the fun thing about Tool is that Maynard, the lead singer, owns a vineyard and winery in the Jerome area, and actually has a little storefront that's actually on the Cocodona course. And one time I actually met him in his store in Jerome outside of Cocodona. So he has a connection to Cocodona. So that's cool.
That is pretty cool.
All right. Icebreaker for you. You're going on a 6-hour flight. What do you bring with you?
I like flying. I do like keeping busy on flights. So I'm having like every entertainment form you could imagine on a 6-hour flight is in my quiver. I'll have a laptop with some movies and shows downloaded. I usually have a book and I'll bring like my Switch to play games. Usually more often than not, I think I'm reading on a plane versus watching something if I can get into a book, if I'm into a book. I like flying, and I do keep like, I need to be like stimulated the whole time. So I'm in some sort of media the entire time.
That sounds fun.
All right. You're deep. Now I know you have a lot of them, so why don't you pick one or two here, and then you can do the second part as well. So explain the reasoning behind your tattoos and describe a tattoo you would like to get.
So tattoos. Yeah, I have a lot of them. You know, I think for me, the meaning kind of comes and goes. Like some of them are meaningful, but some of it, I just kind of like the artist and the style. I go for that American traditional. So yeah, I think the more you get, the less meaning they have. But I do have some special ones. Like I recently got a Cocodona tattoo. So that's meaningful, obviously. And then one I want to get, I really want to get a traffic cone. I want to get a little traffic cone tattoo for you, Ray.
You kind of got to get two little traffic cones, right? To make up the start line.
Yeah.
Or the finish line, both, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Okay. Deep for you. Have you ever sleepwalked? Describe what happened.
Not that I know of. Or at least not in the typical sense, like, you know, like day-to-day life. I don't think I've ever sleepwalked, but I have fallen asleep while walking during a race. Let's say running, but let's be real. It was walking. And that particular moment was the second to last leg of the Moab 240 in 2019. Greg Marshall was pacing me, and apparently we saw a bobcat like eating something, like ripping something apart. And I have no recollection of it. Like I was totally out, like just kind of moving through time and space without being cognizant of or aware of where I was. But yeah, we have like pictures of the bobcat, and it's very clearly, I mean, it's not a great picture, but it happened. Like, it was a real thing, and I wasn't there for it, even though I was. So sure, once during a race, but not in the general sense of sleepwalking.
Well, it's a bummer you missed the bobcat. That sounds cool.
Yeah. All right, deeper for you. Describe what you were like in high school. Is there anything you'd change?
In high school, I was a bit of a nerd, and I think I'm still kind of am that way. I was on the academic decathlon team. I was in band. I was really into those things. And I think the only thing I would change is, like, I wish I had ran cross country. Knowing what I know now, I feel like I do have some natural running talent, and I didn't start running until I was 30. So I wish I did more athletics in high school. And then deeper for you, would you rather be 5 years older or 5 years younger?
Oh, I'd take 5 years younger. I'm happy with life and my age, and I'm not currently scared of aging, but I feel like for the first time in my life, I am starting to notice things that are like age related. Like, a lot of people are younger than me, and like the way people, you know, younger people, kids and stuff refer to me and stuff, your kids, noticing that, you know, like stuff like that. So yeah, I'd take 5 years younger, sure. And I guess, it, you know, it would depend, like, does it mean just to like put the stamp on it, go 5 years like younger, or would that like to relive the last 5 years? Cause I don't think I'd redo it. Like, I'm pretty happy with life, but if it was just like, hey, now I'm, you know, 5 years younger, sure, I'd take that.
Yeah. It's ambiguous. So that's a fair answer.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that's it for today's episode. Again, like, I can't, stress enough how much fun we had, chatting with Joe. Really appreciate him coming on to guest host. Maybe we should do some more like collaborations and guest host stuff in the future, cause that was just a blast. Give us a review. Let us know how you liked this episode. You know, there's a question on Spotify each time asking how you liked it. Let us know things we could do better, things you want to see more of, things you want to see less of. And by see, I mean here. But yeah, we really appreciate you listening, and we'll catch you next time on Distance to Empty. Thanks all.